You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, June 10th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunchbox. Lunchbox? Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On the program today, lecturer of history at Yale University, David Hoysan, on his book, Progressive Inequality, Rich and Poor in New York, 1890 to 1920. What is old is new again, ladies and gentlemen. Maybe that's why we read history. And speaking of history, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I'm literally giddy. Greg Sargent is reporting today. Democrats will introduce a bill in the Senate to raise Social Security benefits. We will discuss. Meanwhile, Mosul in Iraq lost to Islamic extremists. We will discuss also on the program today the push to allow for some relief on existing student debt. It is not enough, ladies and gentlemen. We will discuss as well. And the heartwarming story of an archbishop who apparently way back in the 80s didn't realize that molesting children was a crime. He knew it was morally wrong.
Wait, there's a penal code around that. I'm sorry. I got to do the Irish priest thing. I apologize.
Yes, no.
I guess I was giddy about Social Security too, buddy.
And a Republican congressman comes out and maybe inadvertently, but certainly explicitly says that Supreme Court Justices John Roberts and Anthony Kennedy don't know their ass from their elbows. Plenty more on the program today. Folks, just a reminder for those of you who are joining us for the first time, this program receives its revenue, about 99.7% of its revenue from those people who choose to support the program by becoming members. And then as a bonus, we give them 50 minutes of extra material a day. But we couldn't do the free show without the revenue that we get from our members. There are other ways to support the show, but we will talk about those at the end of the program. But really, it is your membership that makes this show possible. You can become a member today at majority.fm. And also, pick up the Majority Report app. It's totally free. MajorityApp.com. iOS and Android. And you can listen to the past 25 shows if you're a freebie. If you remember the last 1,000 shows, close to it. We're getting close to that number. All on your phone. You can also listen live and IM the program and call the program with one touch of a button. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking to David Hoysan about progressive inequality, rich and poor in New York, back in the, oh, the last century and past. All right, we'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program David Hussein. He is a lecturer of history at Yale University and author of Progressive Inequality, Rich and Poor in New York, 1890 to 1920. Welcome to the program, David.
Thanks so much for having me, Sam.
All right, so let's start with just, if you could, just tell us about the progressive movement and the progressive era, just so that everyone is on the same page as to what we mean by progressives when we talk historically.
Sure. So usually when people invoke the progressive era, they're thinking about a variety of reformers, people who sort of grappled with the merciless nature of unrestrained industrial capitalism from the Gilded Age and tried to sort of rein it in through a variety of social reform movements in cities across the country and through legislation as well that sort of, you know, applied some kind of regulatory apparatus to industrial capitalist businesses. So there are a lot of different ways of understanding the progressives, and there are a lot of different kinds of people that fall under that category. And part of the reason that I wrote the book is that I think there's a tendency to think of progressives in very positive terms and to generally forget the kind of white supremacist race theory part of progressivism, the eugenics part of progressivism, all of which came under that heading at the time as well.
And so, I mean, what, give me a sense of why you think that there is, I mean, why do we have these misconceptions?
I mean, in part because that's largely the way the history is written. There's also the fact, you know, which I should state at the outset, that there were a lot of progressive reformers that did a bunch of good, sort of transformed the conditions of life for a lot of Americans in positive ways. You know, you have the introduction of the beginnings of the progressive income tax, various legislation to control sanitary environment and workplace, workers' compensation, introduction of restrictions on child labor, and so forth. So that's part of the reason I think people prefer, Americans tend to look at the happy side of their history rather than the difficult parts.
Right. And to be fair as well, I mean that those elements of racism were certainly not exclusive to the progressive movement.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Although I think part of the reason that I wanted to write the book is to sort of lend a little bit more of a critical sense to the fact that a lot of the best progressives, a lot of the people that we remember as the best progressives, people like Lillian Wald, who founded the Henry Street Settlement, and, you know, even some housing reformers, who really were trying to create a better world in, on, you know, say on the Lower East Side, in these tenement conditions that everybody remembers as sort of being, you know, terrible, and, you know, all the children having diphtheria and no one having adequate food and, you know, 10 people living in a single room. They were creatures of their time, and they expressed and enacted a whole variety of kind of racism, imperialism that were just part of the language of the time. And that had consequences, and that's what I'm trying to get at, is that the Progressive Era ultimately didn't work. It wasn't enough.
It wasn't enough. And I want to get there, but I want to start with sort of, and certainly there are sort of parallels in terms of what, the Progressive Era grew out of an awareness of a tremendous disparity, wealth disparity, income disparity within the country. And let's just start, though. I mean, talk about that, because I want to lead up to that opening scene in your book, which I think sort of encapsulates sort of the limits of what progressivism was about at that time. But talk about the inequality that existed at that time.
Sure. So, inequality in the 1890s was, in numerical terms, actually not quite as bad as it is today. But it was certainly, in terms of a lived reality, very obvious. You had these, you know, piling up of tremendous fortunes, outsized fortunes that dwarf anything that exists today. Even people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett don't have the kind of relative wealth of someone like John D. Rockefeller had at the beginning of the 1890s. I mean, you're talking, he had about 5% of the entire GDP as his personal wealth, which today would be something on the order of $750 billion. That's sort of a facile comparison. But in any case, you had a real sort of environment in which industrial workers were living in misery and want and dying at an amazing clip on the job. About 35,000 a year died in the workplace or were killed just by the conditions of their work. And on the other hand, these vast fortunes that sort of give the name to the Gilded Age. And I think part of what happened in that period before the Progressive Era was that you had workers beginning to organize and beginning to lash out violently against these kinds of inequalities, and also to defend themselves against the violence of both the state and capitalist businessmen who were using it pretty ruthlessly against them. And that sort of surge in industrial violence through the 1880s and 1890s made wealthy people begin to think to themselves, hey, we better actually do something about this expanding inequality, because it seems like it's getting it's undermining the foundations of the system that has made us so wealthy. The impulse of the Progressive Era and all of those reform movements does come in part from this burgeoning recognition on the part of wealthy Americans that, hey, we need to figure out some solutions for this inequality. And it's not dissimilar to what's going on right now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, the level of violence in terms of the way that the workers responded, it was obviously far greater than today.
Yeah, you know, and it's part of that comes from a sense that violence is actually, at the time, people felt that violence might be a productive avenue for resistance. And indeed, it was. It was more effective then than it could possibly be now, in part because the apparatus of state violence was much less well developed in the 1890s and 1900s than it is today. I mean, when you compare the size of say, just the New York City Police Department today, workers trying to do things like, subway workers in 1916, disgruntled subway workers set a bomb in the Lenox Avenue subway station to destroy company property, with the idea that this would sort of garner some sympathy from the general public. And it was not entirely misguided at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what people don't understand is sort of the level. I mean, there were bombs set off on Wall Street. I mean, this was
That's right.
I think we forget sort of just how militant things were at that time. And I guess the upshot is that there's a growing awareness of the implications of this inequality without that level of violence, at least coming from those who are suffering from the inequality. I mean, the dynamic is very different, I think, today in terms of, you know, if you look at Occupy, you see the level of sort of, I think, violence that came from the authorities.
Right. Although, I mean, there's a different kind of violence in contemporary society that you know is you know our progressive era forebears would have looked at and been you know somewhat aghast when you think about the incarceration rate in 21st century United States. You had nothing like that in the late 19th, early 20th century, and that's a form of state violence that pervades our society. I mean, in every city in the country, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of families that are affected in some way by incarceration and the violence of incarceration. And that is a form of inequality that reproduces itself in lived experience for all these Americans, right?
Yes, indeed. In fact, we had Matt Taibbi on, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago now, talking about sort of that dynamic that,
right.
And certainly others, Glenn Greenwald has written about that as well. But so let's get back to the opening of your book, because I think this sort of captures the conflict, the inner conflict, I guess, of that was embedded in the progressive movement, the sort of attempting to do the right thing, but maybe not necessarily for the best of reasons. I don't know. I don't know what the best way to characterize it, but tell this story.
It's hard to characterize it because it's kind of a crazy story
about Madison Square Garden, because it's like I mean, it's obviously from another time, but it's like it's from another planet. Just tell us that story.
Sure. So Christmas Day, 1899, the Salvation Army decided to, you know, organize a charity event in Madison Square Garden, and what they did was they invited New York's poor, quote unquote.
Let's go back. I just want to go just characterize what the Salvation Army is at that time. I mean, because this seems to go to the heart of this on some level, is that the you know, philanthropy and charity, you know, so back up and just give us a little context on the Salvation Army of the time.
Sure. So the Salvation Army had really just arrived in the United States 17 years earlier and had gotten its feet under it. It was a charity that was looking to essentially, give succor to the lives of the poor in various cities. It had started in England and you know, landed with big fanfare in the United States, in New York, actually, in 1882. And it was trying to address the kinds of urban inequality that were typical of this emerging industrial capitalist landscape. Terrible housing, unemployment, real kind of misery and want in poorer sections of the city. And the things that they would do is they would establish homes for young girls who had become pregnant, or, you know, they tried to, there was a really strong evangelist component to the Salvation Army as well, as there still is today. It was an evangelical Christian organization that was trying to transform the way poor people thought about themselves and about their world and really change their behavior. And that's a key element in a lot of progressive reform.
Right.
You know, this desire on the part of charity do-gooders to instruct the poor in how they can better behave themselves and better act so as to take advantage of the growing wealth of that period. So, in service of that, the Salvation Army set up this dinner in Madison Square Garden, and they invited New York's poor to come and eat dinner on the arena floor. And they sold tickets for $1 a piece to wealthy New Yorkers to come and sit in the mezzanine and watch the meal as an act of charity. And this is one of the most amazing things about the event for me, is that you have wealthy people coming to this event and, you know, basically an event that is class voyeurism in its most naked form. And they imagine themselves to be doing a great charitable deed, to be, you know, really creating a certain kind of atmosphere of understanding between themselves and the poor. And there are some sort of strange little anomalies in this event that that indicate that maybe something else is going on. Like, for instance, some of the poor attendees take dinner baskets out onto the street outside the arena, and rather than going home in gratitude, they set up these impromptu poultry markets and try to sell the chickens for a nickel apiece. And the cops come outside and basically scatter them. And the press the next day essentially called them ungrateful rather than, you know, I mean, today they might be celebrated as entrepreneurs, right?
Right. And what other thing? I mean, first off, it's just such a jaw-dropping a story. And but it also serves as a metaphor for, in some respects, for the, I guess, the problem with progressivism at that in that day and age, because it speaks to its limits, but it also talks about why it could never surpass its limits, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is just the sort of obsession with private philanthropy or private charity as the solution to wealth and income inequality. That, you know, a lot of people who are devoted to an idea of a free market society tend to subscribe to, right? You know, charity has real political limits in terms of the kind of good it can do. And that certainly, you know, if people out there are listening and have lots of money, they should certainly feel free to be charitable and they can make a difference in the world. But in terms of actually changing the structural dynamics of inequality in the United States, it is not going to do it. And I think that's one of the...
Well, it has political and pragmatic limitations. I mean, you know, it's great Christmas dinner. But the fact that people went out to sell the chickens shows
right.
the practical limitations on it, because they were thinking, I'm also going to have to eat on New Year's Day. I'm going to have to eat in February, in March, and in April and May. I mean, that's what that part of the story.
What foresight?
Exactly. I mean, I think that you know, and I have this. I've had this argument in the past with different libertarians that I've had the opportunity to sort of debate on these things as to charity's capacity to handle this. And according to them, you know, all history stopped, I think, you know, after, you know, prior to 1975 or something. But,
right.
You know, this was charity was doing a great job of dealing with.
No, you get this kind of like strange ahistorical nostalgia for some halcyon age that never existed. I mean, you don't even need to look further than David Brooks' column in the Times today.
Right. I couldn't look that far, to be honest with you. That's a bridge too far for me.
It actually captured the voice of many progressives that I write about. You know, Brooks is in this mode of both kind of celebrating the possibilities of libertarian entrepreneurship for the poor, and at the same time saying, well, you know, you can't really give these family tax credits to people who don't know how to act because the culture has really deteriorated, and what we need is paternalist programs. He actually uses the word paternalism to describe the kind of programs that need to be put in place in order to address inequality.
Well,
and he's celebrating it.
I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, because I think that's sort of the interesting thing about today's politics, is that we almost have gradations of the what was problematic about the progressives at that time. And those gradations span, I think, from our president, frankly, all the way to Paul Ryan and beyond, you're moving that way rightward on the spectrum. But before we get there, tell us, okay, so you've got thousands of people who come into Madison Square Garden to basically perform eating for these wealthy donors. And I guess presumably it was almost like watching Sally Struthers, right, on TV, and it allows these rich people to see what their money can do, how much happiness it can bring. Give us a sense of just like how, and you write specifically about New York, but in New York may be sort of the most extreme in some respects, or example of both the inequality and the the level of deprivation, but give us a sense of what it was like at that time. Because, you know, I've had these debates with libertarians where I'm saying, you know, charity may have been working, but there were like 20,000 people sleeping literally on the Bowery around that time. Give us a sense of what New York was like at that time.
Okay, so just, you know, one statistic that always kind of jumps out at me is that on the Lower East Side and many of these most, you know, densely populated urban areas in the world, actually, in the history of the world, they were among the most densely populated and way more densely populated than today. I mean, people think Manhattan is a zoo now. You know, it was a third again as populous in 1890 through that period. You had 20% of children dying. They didn't call it the infant mortality rate. They called it the child death rate. They were much less euphemistic. But a fifth of kids, every fifth child, died of some communicable disease. Diphtheria, diarrhea, typhoid, yellow fever, all sorts of diseases that are easily cured by, you know, or addressed by medical professionals, and were then as well, many of them, because there was no apparatus to give them health care. And that's one of the things that Lillian Wald brought to the Lower East Side. In terms of housing, you certainly had, you know, a kind of, you know, libertarian's dream of unregulated garment production that created whole sweatshop neighborhoods where you had families working in tiny, cramped buildings, apartments, producing garments for major garment manufacturers and then delivering them, you know, in hopes that their houses didn't burn down, which was a real problem because there was an arson ring running around New York in the early 1890s, basically taking advantage of the fact that people had so little sense of connection or affection for the places that they lived that they would take they would get them to take insurance policies out on them and then burn them to the ground and split the proceeds because the fire insurance market was so so badly regulated or practically unregulated.
So you'd have an apartment building or a tenement house, I guess, where, I don't know, 30 apartments, one or two people might do that to take the insurance out, right? And then so the other 28 families, they just lose out.
Right. I mean, I tell a story at the you know, near the beginning of the book as well about a saloon owner who, you know, his saloon was in a tenement and on the bottom floor. And he couldn't make the payments on his Budweiser taps, which he had leased. And he did this. He engaged in one of these arson fraud arrangements with a sort of handy criminal. And a four-year-old girl in one of the tenement apartments died because the fire got out of control and the building burned to the ground. And, you know, the guy was then ultimately the saloon owner actually made his escape to Europe with his cut of the proceeds. But the guy that he worked with was tried and then sentenced to, I believe, life in prison.
So that just gives people just sort of a sense. I mean, the idea of one in five children dying and not because as a function of both the conditions they're living in and their lack of access to health care that could have prevented those deaths, or at least a certain percentage, a significant percentage of them, even though they were exposed to stuff that they wouldn't otherwise be exposed to.
Right.
It just gives people, I think, a sense of what's going on. And then meanwhile, just blocks away, less than a couple of miles away, people are living in some of the most exquisite mansions, I imagine, and living a lifestyle that even in other parts of this country would be unimaginable.
Yes, and some of those mansions, you know, I mean, when you, if you know, any of your listeners are in New York and haven't been to the Frick Museum, you know, that mansion is still there, and it's a sort of indication of how that wealthy class lived at the time on Fifth Avenue. It's sort of unbelievably remarkable in its opulence.
Okay, so let's talk about what the progressive program was at that point, because I think the book essentially tells the story of the progressive movement was effective in some respects, but largely in its largest program, I guess, or its largest rationale was not effective. And it had to do with this notion of of focusing on the individual. So let's get into that aspect of it.
Right. So, you know, ascribing one goal to progressivism or to progressives is always pretty tricky. But I think in general, you can say that you know, the progressive movement in all its various forms was a reaction to the kinds of exacerbated inequality that characterized the period. And that was sort of the goal of a lot of different progressive organizations, was we need to redress this inequality. We need to figure out how to make it better, how to make conditions for workers better, you know, not least of all so that they stop blowing things up in anger, or, you know, organizing into pesky unions. You know, in that respect, you do see sort of some successes, right? I talk about in the book the strike of the shirtwaist workers in 1909 to 1910, a very famous strike in U.S. labor history that sets the groundwork for the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, and who ultimately, with the Amalgamated Workers, Garment Workers, form the basis for the CIO in the 1930s, right? So there you have a direct kind of connection between the progressive era, you know, progressive era democratic activism and the moment in U.S. history when inequality really starts being addressed more comprehensively through the state and through worker organization. But then you also have all of these wealthy people who are trying to teach poor people how to act, or to control their behavior, whether through housing regulation, you know, not allowed to put stuff on the fire escape, with, you know, nary a worry about what that means in terms of, well, where do we put our stuff? Do we just not have stuff? You know, regulation to change the construction of buildings rather than to change landlords' responsibility for their property. You have all sorts of efforts to transform the material lives of workers that involve workers changing their behavior rather than the state providing them with some kind of greater protection or greater resources.
And that includes also like an education. In other words, it's not simply you've got to put on a nicer tie or you have to speak more eloquently. There was a broader program which sounds, I think, you know, at first blush to be, you know, sort of, well, if we have the proper worker training, et cetera, et cetera. And the point is that a lot of the gains that we made in those areas are actually are a function of other gains that we have made that the progressives didn't push. In other words, they did not push. And I think, again, going back to that Madison Square Garden story,
right.
They provided the food, but they specifically would not provide the structures for where the workers and people who were not working, obviously, could
right.
empower themselves. This was
right.
as much about maintaining control as mm-hmm. anything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, you see that in it's sort of there's an ideological adherence to the idea of the free market and the state that does not intervene. And, you know, in that sense, it is very much of a piece with contemporary libertarianism. You know, a lot of these folks were raised and educated themselves on the idea, the sort of classical laissez-faire economic view. And so they were not interested in you talk about people remember the progressive era as a moment in the United States. And I think, you know, Thomas Piketty, whose book is sort of doing a lot of good business these days, talks about this, that, you know, the U.S. invented the progressive income tax in, 1913, I believe. And, you know, the reality of that progressive income tax was at the time the top marginal rate was 6%. You can't really fund a comprehensive educational program of the kind that you start seeing in the 30s and 40s with a 6% top marginal rate. It just doesn't cut it. And I think that's, you know, that's part of what we're debating today, again, is this question of how powerful should state intervention be in redistributing economic goods.
And it would go
for purposes like education.
Right. Well, I mean, I think you in a piece that you wrote about what progressives taught us not what not to do. You make
right.
the point that and here's where I want to sort of bring it up to today, because We can attribute this dynamic, this sense of like, we will, we can teach the poor and the misbegotten and the unemployed new skills. We can give them mm-hmm. education. We can provide charity,
right.
and even charity in the sense of like, we can redistribute some of our highest, in our highest income strata. We can redistribute that, but. So I would say that the reluctance to actually really engage in what needs to be done is not just libertarian, but it's also neoliberal in the way that we sort of refer to neoliberal in this country. So,
yeah, and that's a reflection as well of something that was very current in the progressive era, which was this idea that, you know, economic growth is the answer to all our ills, which is, you know, it's sort of heresy to contradict that. But, you know, the idea that we must grow. I think the new reform agenda coming out of the right is this, their new document is called Room for Growth. And that focus on economic growth is very much very, very neoliberal. And that's why you see these kinds of efforts to privatize education through charter schools. And, ostensibly you're going to be teaching poor people how to readjust their lives through the mechanisms of the market, rather than through some kind of more communal democratic process.
Exactly. And you make the point that the things like a broader education, things like all the things that we sort of talk about now in terms of providing broad social mobility actually mm-hmm. came as a function not of trying to enhance the individual's social mobility, but of broad structural reforms that actually followed after the progressive movement. And as if on some level that the
right.
progressive movement sort of set the table and did some of the work in terms of sort of the broad political sort of narratives, but the
creating the idea of the regulatory state, basically, but not actually following through on it in any kind of comprehensive fashion that would have really addressed inequality. But the idea was there. The sort of intellectual foundation was there. And then what you had was millions of workers organizing in opposition to the conditions that they were suffering under during the Depression and before, that gave FDR and the New Dealers the kind of political capital they needed to actually make broad interventions and, you know, really start regulating industry and giving the workers the protection that they needed in order to bargain collectively for a decent and dignified life.
And that seems to be what's genuinely missing. I mean, you know, it's funny because today there was a story in the Washington Post about Bill Gates and the sort of his push of the Common Core. And we talk about charter schools. And charter schools are sort of, it seems to me, to be the perfect example of that sort of Madison Square Garden dynamic again,
mm-hmm.
where you have hedge funders and wealthy elites going in and providing education for only 6% of New York's kids, but they're bringing in a lot of private resources. They're giving these specific individuals a chance, but they're doing it at the expense of public education across the board in the city and leaving out, obviously, people who don't have, you know, rewarding only those families, let's say, mm-hmm. who have the social capital to work within the system that they're talking about, whether or not they have like a family structure that allows the parents to go in and get involved in the lottery and go to the different meetings that they have to go to, or whether or not the kid's just lucky enough to have parents who are willing to make that kind of sacrifice or savvy enough to make that kind of sacrifice.
Right, I mean, I was going to say luck plays. I'm glad you mentioned luck, because luck plays an enormous role in that sort of situation, and it's something that most people are never willing to engage with as sort of a major factor in life outcome in the United States. Everybody think it comes down to hard work and, you know, this idea of social capital or you know, a sense of savviness, and certainly that contributes, but there is this enormous degree of luck involved. And I think that, you know, the fact that charter schools are, you know, in terms of their spaces, as well, I think one of the, you know, most kind of troubling aspects of the charter movement is the way that they actually do take all of this public funding and that public funding gets funneled away from the public educational system, the broader public education system. I want to be careful, though, because, you know, I do feel like there are a lot of devoted teachers who try to make a difference in charter schools and, you know, work very hard and so forth. You know, I have some friends who teach at charter schools, but I think the movement as a whole, you're absolutely right. It's sort of an abandonment of the idea of a really broad and successful public educational system, basically through the idea that, you know, again, this neoliberal idea that if you organize things privately through, you know, and allow management to operate privately, it will be more efficient than if run through the government, which people just sort of assume and accept as a basic truism, and it's just not true.
Well, I mean, aside from it being sort of quantifiably untrue, I mean, we now, you know, we there's plenty of research about the inefficiency of private prisons, the famous story of Chicago selling off their meter reading, their parking meter revenues for 75 years at a basically a billion shy of where they should have what they should have been.
Right.
I mean, on and on. But
to cover a short-term budget deficit, right?
Indeed. But beyond that, what it also does is it disempowers our government in some fashion, which then also has the impact of making it impossible to make those structural reforms that would provide a broad relief across the board to as many people as possible. So,
right.
You know, while we can all show up at Madison Square Garden and watch a couple of thousand people eat their Christmas dinner, meanwhile, these people don't have dinners for the rest of the year, and there's thousands more who didn't get into Madison Square Garden.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody leaves there feeling like we've done something.
That's right. And they get to actually use that as political and social capital to continue operating the way that they do. And honestly, you know, I mean, we talk about that Madison Square Garden event as strange and jaw-dropping and you know, but I came across that piece of research back in 2004, and right around the same time the RNC was going on in New York City, and you know, it was the kind of compassionate conservative moment, and you had this major photo op with a whole bunch of Republican delegates to the RNC at a soup kitchen in Harlem. You know, basically having their picture taken, giving out food to you know, the physical embodiment, the public embodiment of poverty in New York. And, you know, the dynamics of that were not dissimilar to what was going on in Madison Square Garden. And I think that's part of the reason that I wrote the book, is that, you know, I really did see this kind of resonance between the progressive era and our own day. In a whole bunch of different ways.
And again, we can see this in Paul Ryan telling us his made-up story about the poor child who would rather not have a lunch given
right.
to him, but rather just one made in a brown bag at home. I mean, the story turns out to be a total fabrication. But even
right.
if we were to take it as true, it still sort of shows this mentality. And I would also argue that President Obama, you know, in talking to the black community and saying that, you
mm-hmm.
know, this is about you pulling yourself up with your bootstraps and being socially responsible, that's all well and good. But more of that social responsibility comes once you have the foundation of a broad structure that empowers you.
That's true, and I think it's also, you know, that also speaks to the kind of relentless individualism of the approaches from both the Democratic and the Republican Party and the way that they, you know, kind of narrate the American dream. It's all about people, individuals working hard, right, rather than about how we as a society decide there is a level of poverty and want beneath which we will not allow any citizen in our country to fall. And I think there are other developed countries in the world that have made a collective decision around that question, and the decision has been to have that level be much, much higher than
right. And it goes beyond even a safety net. It goes or a floor. It also goes to like how inevitably we're going to tilt the playing field, because the existence of government necessarily will tilt the playing field. It's just a question of in which direction it's going to tilt it. And
That's right.
I think we see this even today in the student loan argument. I mean, there's another option that no one speaks of, you know, aside from just sort of providing some loan relief, that is offer free education. And then all of this becomes moot. But those words cannot be spoken, apparently.
No, well, and they also require a politically toxic answer, which is massive redistribution. You can't provide a free education unless the government is actually willing to have confiscatory taxes. And I think that's something that's why everybody is freaking out about Thomas Piketty, is that this wild idea that you actually take the wealth of some people who are enormously wealthy and apply it to the benefit of the larger community through some tried and true methods. And you saw that argument for the reason that we don't have single payer health care.
Right.
Right. It's exactly the same problem. Everybody has to, all Democrats and Republicans alike, have to speak the language of the market. Or at least they believe they do, in order to be electable. Or perhaps it's only in order to get reasonable campaign contributions, which is another way of saying to be electable.
Indeed. David Hussein, the book is Progressive Inequality, Rich and Poor in New York, 1890 to 1920. Thanks so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Sam. I really appreciate being on. Have a good one.
You too. All right, folks. Went a little long. We're going to head into the funner half of the show, wherein we talk about all the fun of Alex Jones, a guy who we can only hope is insane. Because if he's not insane, he is probably one of the most sort of despicable and just utterly reprehensible, I dare I say, incredibly evil people. To grace, at least a microphone. And that, you know, there's a lot of competition there. And maybe in the fun half, we will also do a random rush. The predictions of, and this will make Jimmy Reefercake very happy, the predictions of Colorado turning into just a complete source of mayhem now that they have legalized marijuana. Well, we'll see if that happened. You can guess where that went. Also, a Republican congressman inadvertently tells John Roberts and Anthony Kedney, you have no idea what you're talking about. All that and more as we head into the fun half. Folks, a reminder, it is your memberships that make this show possible on a daily basis. If you have the financial wherewithal, please become a member today at majority.fm. If you don't have the financial wherewithal, but do want access to the funner half of the program, we will not shut anyone out for financial reasons. Email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We will work something out with you. Also, if you want to spend no money and make virtually no effort at supporting this program, you can still do that. If you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majoritireportkickback.com. All you got to do is, it's a one-time deal for you. You go to majoritireportkickback.com, you click on the Amazon link, you bookmark that, you keep that in your bookmark ruler on top of your browser. Whenever you want to buy something from Amazon, click on that link. It'll take you to Amazon. You'll notice no difference, but we get a kickback. That's why we call it majoritireportkickback.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off, and we get a little something-something from that, too. You get great coffee. It's a great company. It's fair trade. Everybody, that's a win-win-win-win situation. That's like the quad win. Sync win. I don't know how to say it. I don't know what I'm talking about. MajorityApp.com. MajorityApp.com. And also to get the app and also give us a review on iTunes. You want to call the show? 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM. This is where Matt will play the outro music to the program. And the number again, 646-257-3920. What was that? What were you doing, Michael? We want to do that voicemail thing?
You remember that?
Yeah, but we haven't worked it out yet.
Okay.
We need a process for that.
Right.
All right. We'll be back in just a moment.